This episode is brought to you in part by Regent College, Vancouver, Canada. Experience God's call to a life more abundant with our 1 to 2 week summer courses. Sign up today at rgnt.net/summer.
And I was like, wait a minute. Everything that he's been calling me is a racial slur.
Wow.
It wasn't just us just going back and forth and trading insults the way that sometimes your kids, at least where I come from, you trade insults, you roast people, you trade insults, right?
The dozens.
He's saying these things to me and it's mean because I'm black. I didn't say anything else to him. I just kind of, I backed off. I didn't say anything else to this kid because it was a kid that I liked, that I respected, that I whatever. And it was like, he called me these horrible words. Some of them I hadn't even heard of before until that. So that's some, like, high-level racism right there.
This is Where You're From, an origin story podcast at the intersection of faith and culture that digs into the influences and experiences that shape who we are today. Join us as we gain insight into the Bible's wisdom for all, regardless of where we're from. Hey y'all, this is Rasul Berry. Thanks for joining me on Where You're From. Get ready for some thought-provoking perspective because we are talking with none other than Ali Henney. Ali is a writer, speaker, advocate, minister, and vice president of The Witness, an organization committed to empowering Black Christians toward liberation from racism. You can find out more about Ali by clicking the links in the show notes or by visiting whereyourfrom.org. That's whereyafrom.org. Please join me as I ask Ali Henney, where you're from?
Hey, well, I'm from a couple different places. I was born in Missouri. I grew up in the Kansas City area and then lived in southern Missouri for a while, Springfield, Missouri. Then lived in Virginia outside of Washington, D.C., and now I'm in Chicago. So I feel like I'm from a few different places.
Which in and of itself kind of begins to unpack some of the interesting layers of Ali Henney, because many people know about Kansas City or St. Louis, but then there's all these other places that people find themselves in, Missouri, and especially even African Americans. Tell us a little bit about that, like, small town life, rural life, and how that reality informed you.
Yeah. So that whole, that small town thing, people who come from small towns have a lot of pride in where they come from. They have a lot of pride in their little town, especially for Black folks that grow up in small town. There is a feeling, there's a sentiment about being a Black small town person that some of us carry, because a lot of times whenever people talk about Blackness or they talk about the Black experience, they're talking about a very city experience, a very urban experience. Well, a Black person living in a small town, like, there's a lot of stuff that we can't necessarily relate to in that city experience. But I, at least where I was from, being a Black person, in a small town, it's definitely an interesting experience, especially a predominantly white small town, which is where I came from. And oftentimes I wasn't like my family, we were not the only Black family that lived there. I believe that whenever I lived there, there was a Black community. We had a church. Now I think that there are multiple Black churches, but the Black community was probably about, we'll say, like 200 to 300 people, which is still fairly small. So you go into spaces and, like, you're outnumbered.
Wait, so let me just make sure I'm doing the math. You're saying around 200 Black people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's like 1%.
Yeah, that's like 1% of the population. So really, like, very, very small number of people. Mm-hmm. So I think about, like, my class in school, we had at varying points around like 150 to 200 people. But in my class of, like, 185, 200 people, there were only I can literally like count the black people in my class. So like there was me, there was Dee Dee, there was Charisse, there was Brandon, there was Anthony, there was Whitney. That's six of us in my class of 185 people. And so so most of the time, whenever you're doing things, you're the only black person. And so then having experiences that are kind of almost like this dual kind of thing where, you know, my family, my grandma lived in an area of town that existed because of segregation. So like, you know, whenever my mom and my grandma moved to the town where I was raised, my aunties and stuff moved to this town, even though it was 1970, it was still segregated. So there was only one part of the town that we were allowed to live in. And they had actually torn down some of the black people's houses to build housing projects. So my mom lived in the projects in this little town. And then my grandma was eventually able to get a HUD house. And she got a HUD house on the other street where they were building HUD houses and stuff for black people. And so a lot of where I existed, a lot of the space that I would call home exists in kind of like this legacy of segregation. It's like a lot of us who grew up in the town were descendants of people who were enslaved by people in the town. So you start doing genealogical research and you see certain last names that black people have. And then there are also names that white people in the town have. And it's like, I wonder what that dynamic could be about. But at the same time, nobody like really, you know, looks too deep into it or talks too deep into it because you can't, because there's so much there. There's a lot there. That's like a podcast in and of itself.
Got it. That's painting quite the picture. That sounds like a recipe for some really difficult and dynamic interactions. But to kind of zone in a little closer to home, tell me a little bit about what your family environment was like growing up.
Yeah, so I grew up in what people call like an extended family. So it wasn't just like kind of the dominant culture idea of family is a mom, a dad, one and a half kids, and a dog and whatever, like, you know, pets, like whatever. That wasn't how I grew up. I grew up in a family that it was my grandma. She was like kind of the main person in the family. And so my grandma had seven kids. Six of them survived to adulthood. One of my uncles passed away whenever he was a teenager. He had epilepsy, and so he had some complications with that and passed away. But then my mom was number four out of the seven. So my grandma had three kids, and then she didn't have kids for like 13 years, and then she had four kids. And so the dynamic of that was then it was my mom and then all of her younger siblings that moved with my grandmother to the small town that I grew up in. And so then I grew up with my mom, my three aunts. One of my aunts had kids who were around my age, 3 years above, 3 years, twins, 3 years below. And then another one of my aunts had one, a baby that was a baby. He's not a baby anymore, but he was a baby whenever I was growing up. So I'm 9 years older than him. But I grew up in this like kind of large, loud, extended family. So then my aunties, two of them, you know, got married. So I had my uncles and stuff around. Then I also had some of the cousins who were from my grandma's older kids. So like my grandma's older kids, they lived in another town. So I had like, we would all get together. They would come around and everything. So I had my big cousins. I had my big aunts, my uncle, my big cousins. And then my sister is 12 years older than I am. So my sister in some ways was almost kind of like a parent too. And then my parents were together for a while. My dad was in the Air Force and then they divorced whenever I was seven. But I just had like this, just have kind of like this big, big, complicated family that I was raised by not just parents, but also by my grandmother, also by my aunties. One of my uncles was kind of like the surrogate dad to me. And my older auntie and uncle, in a lot of ways, they were kind of like grandparents. And so, yeah, it was just, it was definitely a scene. It was dynamic, but it was great.
I can relate to that so much. Like when I think of family growing up, It was grandma, mom, aunts, uncle, cousins. Like, it's all part of the tapestry of our ecosystem, of our family. But what was that like for you? Do you have fond memories of that?
Yeah, you know, in general, definitely fond memories. Like, I feel like that for the most part, my memories of that were good. Faced various hardships and trials and just things that were difficult. People in my family wrestled with addiction. People in my family had issues just with spouses, with lovers, with whatever, just all these different things. In late elementary school, early middle school, my grandma had suffered a stroke, and then she was diagnosed with lung cancer. She had been a smoker for a long time. She had had some health complications because of that. And so she had quit smoking and she had not been smoking for several years. But then she again was experiencing just some health complications, had a stroke, was diagnosed with lung cancer. She had pretty much like the Surgeon General's warning on the pack of cigarettes, like pretty much everything that could possibly have happened as a result of being a smoker happened to my grandmother. And so with my grandma being the matriarch, kind of the solid rock of the family, her then getting ill and then having to deal with that illness and wrestle with healthcare, wrestling with so many other health problems, it made her treatment complicated. A lot of my family works actually in the healthcare field. My mom is a speech pathologist. I have one aunt that's an RN, another aunt that was an LPN. A couple of my other aunties and big cousins and stuff worked in hospitals and nursing homes and that type of thing. And so I think that we were privileged in the sense of we knew what kind of questions to ask. We understood what we were dealing with. At the same time, you have someone who's very, very sick. And because of where we lived, my grandma, she's the one that was one of my primary caregivers while my mom was at work. And so then she's sick and she's having all these health problems. And like, me and my cousin, one of my cousins actually did physically, that was her address, lived with my grandma. But the rest of us lived there too, if only part-time. I spent probably, you know, it was 50-50 between my formal address where I live. My mom had her own house, but then also my grandma's address. I was there. I maybe was even at my grandma's house 60 or 70% of the time, maybe sometimes even 80% of the time, depending on what year we're talking about. And you're in this place where the person who's supposed to be taking care of you needs care. And so my cousins and I, we ended up really like taking care of our grandma. And we took care of her not because we were asked to do it. Like, it wasn't, that wasn't something that was put on us as young people. So, you know, we would have been 15, 12, and 9, and then the baby was like 2 or 3 years old. At that point, you know, it wasn't like somebody was saying, like, you have to do this, but it was like, it was like the right thing to do. So it was like, you know, the house needs to be clean. The dishes need to be done. Grandma just had radiation. She's not going to be able to do that. So we're going to do it. We got to eat. you cook for yourself, like all these different things, you know.
Let me ask you something. Painted this picture that I'm seeing two things collide. Like, you described your grandmother as this, you know, rock of the family, matriarch. And then you also are describing this significant health crisis with those who can understand the severity of it because they work in that field. How did that influence and impact the vibe, the experience of the family, you know, because that's a pretty significant reality to happen?
Oh, you know, it was devastating. Terminal diagnoses and terminal illnesses bring out things in people. It can bring up childhood trauma for some people. And so some of that sometimes can surface where they need to settle a score with the parent who's ill before they go. There are some people who take on the role of being the person that's providing the care and doing this. And then other people get upset because then they feel like that individual is hoarding spending time with that parent that they don't get. There are sometimes the people who are the helpers get frustrated because others are trying to help, but they're helping in their own way, but it's maybe not necessarily the help that they think should be given. Somebody might have money and just say, you know, here, I'm going to give money. I'm going to give you, you know, $200. I'm going to give you $50. I'm going to slide you 20. I mean, whatever. So it really brings out a lot of different dynamics in people. And I even think about with us kids, with the four of us, there were kind of some of these different dynamics playing out in a microcosm. And so, like, you know, Stacy was the one, she was the oldest one. She had been living with my grandma since she was 9. And so she was there, you know, being a helper, providing care, whatever. But then it also, there were some points where I think it got difficult for her because she was also a teenager. And so she was wanting to go out with her friends and hang out and whatever, you know. So then I'm the next oldest one. So then I kind of get thrown into these situations where I'm spending the night with my grandma because my cousin wants to have sleepovers, as, you know, she was entitled to. I'm put in positions where, you know, one time my grandma fell. And so she fell a couple of times, actually, while I was at home with her. There was one time that my grandma was just violently ill, and she didn't want me to tell my aunt what had happened, and she just wanted me to clean everything up and to not tell my aunt, who was the RN, why she was sick, like what had happened and whatever. And I remember there was a point where I was trying to clean this stuff up, and I was like, I cannot do this. And so, like, I acted like I was going to get some more cleaning supplies, and I went in the kitchen and I called my aunt, and I was crying, and I was just like, you have got to come over here. Grandma is very sick. Like, this is a horrible situation. And so my aunt came over. She was in nurse mode and took care of everything. And then afterward, you know, she talked to me and she was just like, you know, you did the right thing. And that was something that was important for me because there were times when I didn't feel like I was doing the right thing. So for a grown-up to finally kind of see me and acknowledge, like, you know what, you did the right thing. You should not have had to have dealt with this by yourself. I needed to know about this. That was something that was life-giving for me in that situation. But all that then to say that you're watching a person over the course of months or years, even sometimes, and you're having to recognize these different moments where this person wasn't who they used to be. You know, my grandmother, like, she's a very nice, very kind woman, but she was sick and was in so much pain. You know, she's on morphine. She's on megadoses of morphine. So she just would just get cranky. And I remember one time I was just so upset about this. And I was talking with my aunt because, again, you know, one of those like, you know, Allie, like, I feel like I can't do anything right. And so then my aunt, again, like, in a moment, I was just really upset. And she was just like, grandma's sick. Like, she's on all this medicine. She's not in her right mind. And that's not fair. That nobody should have to deal with that. And so it's just, it made me so acutely aware of injustice and issues and problems in the world. And it made me into a person that wants to fight for that little person, that person who's not seen sometimes. But there were times in that I didn't feel seen. And so in those moments where my aunt, where different people, where I felt seen, that made all the difference. And so that's really what has inspired me and sparked me to be a person that speaks up and fights for the person who maybe isn't feeling like they're being seen.
I got to pivot because so while you have this backdrop of this just epically tragic challenge of caring for the caregiver, like, you also are experiencing life as what you describe a super minority in school.
Yes.
What was that like? You know, and especially in light of what's going on at home, like, what was school? What did school mean for you? And what was that experience for you?
So, you know, I'm a bit of a nerd. And so I loved school. My mom actually started out in the schools as a speech pathologist. She is a professor at a college now, but kind of her preference, like, that what she loved working with, like, the little kids, like, especially like kindergarten age, which is a lot of times whenever people are going to have communication disorders, those are the ages.
I'm a witness. I had speech pathology training when I was in kindergarten.
Oh, hey. Okay.
That's right. Yes. So shout out to moms.
Yes. That was my mom's training. So my mom actually worked in the schools for a long time until then she started working in a clinical setting within the university. And so I grew up as a teacher's kid, essentially. So my mom is a teacher. Yeah, she does the speech pathology, but she's a teacher. Like, that's who she is. So I was a teacher. I was a teacher's kid, and I loved going to school. My mom worked at the elementary school that I attended, and so many of my teachers, I knew they would be at my house. My mom would have the school bridge club, and so it was a monthly night where they would all get together and play bridge. And May was the month for my house. There were several of the teachers that all had kids at the same time. So we were at birthday parties and all these other types of things and whatever. So I always knew my teachers. My mom knew my teachers, you know, really, really well and everything. So school was, for the most part, an enjoyable experience for me. But being in a small town school, you know everybody, at least in your grade, if not, you know, in the grades above and below you. And this was a small rural town with the Civil War history, Union and Confederate history, with racial divisions, all these other types of things. And it was not an uncommon experience to hear the prejudices and the ignorance of my classmates, because the Black kids in my grade would often be like the only Black person that some of these people had ever interacted with in their entire life. And so, and I've talked about this with some of the Black kids that I grew up with. I've had this conversation with some of them as adults, and different classes going to the same school at different years, different time periods. We all came away with some very like distinct experiences. And so like the first distinct experience that a lot of us had was showing up at school and like realizing immediately that you are different. I mean, you see white people on TV, like, you know, you see white people everywhere that you go in town, and like, you just but it doesn't register until you show up in that classroom and you're like, oh, wait a minute, these people are different than me. These people don't listen to the same music. They don't eat the same types of foods. They don't, like, you just know. Like, you just know immediately that you're different. And so then in knowing immediately that you're different, other people recognize that you're different. So you have the experiences of just, especially, you know, if you start to get to be a teenager, people asking you very invasive questions about your body, about how you are as a person, or all these other different things. You have that kind of experience. You experience usually people calling you racial slurs. You experience exclusion. So like one of my cousins was talking about how he remembered, like, you know, everybody was you know, really, really cool with him and everything at school. But then he would notice that he would never get invited to parties. And so, like, you know, people would be talking. And so I thought about that. I'm like, you're right. People did not invite me to their parties. I was talking to another friend who was like, yeah, you know, I would have boys who would like me, who would say that they like me, but they couldn't go out with me because like their parents wouldn't approve. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that very same thing happened to me. I remember one of my best friends, and I look back and I'm like, we probably would have like actually dated. We became just really close, and we were like literally just best friends. And I realized, you know what? I have never been in this dude's house. He had been in my house multiple times. I've been to my house multiple times. I started driving before him. And so like we would, you know, different practices and stuff, because we were involved in band together. We were involved in cross country sports, like whatever together. And so like I would pick him up and drop him off. His parents never invited me into his house. They would be nice to me. Like if they saw me in public, they would be nice to me, but never invited me into their house. Never, like, whatever. So you have like all of these experiences. And then of course you have just the flat out racism that people engage in and that they think is okay. That's the wildest part of it, is that, I mean, there's some people that know, okay, you know, yeah, I'm not supposed to say the N-word. Like, that's not really a nice thing. Or some people know, kind of, you know, they have this general kind of idea of like, yeah, you're not supposed to talk bad about Black people, but they still do. And it's not every single person. It's not every single, but it's like enough that you're sort of like, Oh, wow. And you are able to identify who is racist and whose family. And you'll say like, oh, so-and-so said something to me. And then, you know, like a relative's like, oh, yeah, you know, I know their daddy. Their daddy's racist. That family's prejudiced. Like, you know, don't talk to them. Don't whatever. Like whatever, because they're prejudiced. Like, yeah, I'm surprised they didn't call you worse than that.
Yeah. And there's one thing in particular that you describe. And it was this pivotal moment. And similar to trying to make sense of navigating caring for a caretaker, you're just kind of figuring out life and going through the world. And then there's almost like this peculiar sense of, wait a minute, something's not right. Or like something is happening that's off. You describe this moment that it, on one end seems just like, you know, adolescence that you realize later, wait, this was actually a sign of something deeper.
Well, some of the things that it felt like I would get in trouble for at home, my fifth grade teacher valued. And so it was like, I feel alive in this space. And so history was something that I really enjoyed. And so my teacher was always, you know, really happy to call me whenever I would share, you know, like little known facts about the president or about like whatever was going on. But I think that it also kind of annoyed my peers. And there's all these kind of dynamics that are just kind of dynamics, I think, any person would experience. So the weird thing for girls is that smart girls are popular until like about fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. So I had hit that wall. I had hit that wall at 11 years old of where me being smart wasn't a cool thing. It wasn't like, oh, she's so cool because she's smart. She can name all the presidents and she can blah, 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 blah. It was suddenly this person is really annoying. And I wasn't like trying to be like a know-it-all. I wasn't trying to flex. I wasn't trying to stunt on people. I was just literally very excited about learning. And so after a while, I started to notice that my stock kind of started to decline. And in fifth grade, you kind of start to care about your stock a little bit with your peers and everything. So yeah, I noticed like, definitely. Oh, my stock is starting to decline. So what can I do? And so I just devised this plan. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try to get in, because I was a tomboy. So I still am a tomboy. But I was a tomboy. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to try to get in with some of these dudes in my class. Like, I'm going to try to be friends with them. And like, they're going to think that I'm cool and it's going to be cool, whatever. So in the midst of all of this, as I'm wheeling and dealing and trying to get my fifth grade street cred or whatever, a group of boys made a bet with me that I couldn't go the whole week without talking in school. And so it was a dare. It was a bet. It was a dare. I was like, okay, fine. If this, like, this gonna make me cool. And they didn't think that I could do it. But I was silent. I was quiet. I didn't say anything. So then what was interesting about that is that my silence then started to become inconvenient for a bunch of different people. My teacher, like, first of all, was like, oh, wait a minute, nobody's participating in class. Like, I need for you to participate in class. Like, all of a sudden was like, you know, wait a minute. My peers, all of a sudden, like, oh, we actually need this girl to talk. Like, she's actually, you know.
So what did they do about the bet then?
The bet was still going. The bet was still the bet. Right. So then my teacher was just like straight up like, you know, fine, y'all can do this bet, but she needs to talk in class. Mm. And so it was like, okay, so you're going to talk in class. What ended up happening is that some of my friends started like, quote unquote, giving me permission to speak. Mm. Which with the that's a dynamic in and of itself, given the black kid permission to speak. But they realized that me being quiet was inconvenient for them.
So your silence was exposing their silence in the classroom. And so then it would put more pressure on them to speak. So they didn't want that smoke. So then they're like, okay,
oh, wait a minute, we need you to talk. Like, she's not talking. Oh, but she knows things that we need answers to. Like, you know, she knows how to do this. She knows how to, like, whatever, we need her to explain this to us, whatever the situation was. So anyway, we get through, I win the bet. I show up on my, because it was a Monday to Friday. I went the whole week, didn't say nothing to nobody, unless, of course, you know, I had to say something in class. Even then, I still, like, rationed my participation. Like, I wasn't, you know, as like, oh, let me jump up and talk as much as I would. I just kind of hung back, just wouldn't do whatever unless somebody, like, solicited me to say something. Sure. I didn't say anything.
So when you come in on Monday, because you're triumphant, you've accomplished the thing. There's nothing more cool in fifth grade than a bet, a dare,
and you did
winning it.
It,
right? So what are you expecting? What do you think is going to happen on Monday?
So I'm walking in there, my head's on swole, right? Like, I'm walking up in there like, look, I did this. We are the champion, my friend. I'm thinking, like, I'm going to get something out of it. Like, y'all are going to give me something, even if it's just a pat on the back, whatever. And so one of the boys is just kind of like, yeah, well, like, you don't get anything for it. Like, I kind of wish that you would have even that you would have just like stopped talking, period, and like wouldn't talk anywhere and whatever. Mm. And so I'm like, what? And so he's telling me that I'm annoying and all this other type of stuff. And so then I'm just kind of like, you know, but I did the bet. Like I did what we agreed to do. Like, you know, I should get something out of this. And so he calls me a slur, but I didn't recognize it as a slur. Like, you know, he called me like a jigaboo. And I was like, I had no idea what that was. So I was just kind of like, oh, okay, whatever. Like, you know, dork, like whatever, like keep it moving. So then, you know, he's mad at me again. He's going back at you. And so then he calls me a spear thrower. So I'm like, spear thrower, what on earth is that? Like, why is he saying this? This is like, and so, you know, I'm going back, you know, I'm calling him, you know, everything but a child of God. And he is like, unfazed, but he's saying these words and laughing about it. And so some of the others are kind of, you know, snickering and stuff about it. And so I'm just sitting here because I had not heard these words before. And I'm just like, what? So then, you know, I'm going back and I'm going back and forth and I'm, you know, whatever. So then he called me a porch monkey. And so I knew what that was. That was one that I knew what that was. And I was like, wait a minute. Everything that he's been calling me is a racial slur.
Wow.
It wasn't just us just going back and forth and trading insults the way that sometimes, you know, kids, you know, at least where I come from, you trade insults, you roast people, you trade insults, right? He's saying these things to me and it's mean because I'm black. Mm. I didn't say anything else to him. I just kind of, I backed off. I didn't say anything else to this kid. Because it was a kid that I liked, that I respected, that I whatever. And it was like, he called me these horrible words. Some of them I hadn't even heard of before until that. So that's some, like, you know, high-level racism right there.
Right. Which means that he had heard these things before, and not just in passing, but had a certain fluency in his racism. And the fact that that was the one thing that he kept going to over and over again.
Over and over again.
This is how you see me.
Yes, there was intent behind it. He didn't want me to talk anymore, and he was using those words to shut me up. And the thing about it was, somebody would be like, well, you know, did you tell a teacher? No, I didn't. And the reason why I didn't tell the teacher was because I had been called the N-word multiple times at school. And nobody ever did anything about it.
Wow.
It was just sort of like, you know, this kind of, you know, now, don't say those words, blah, 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 blah. I mean, you know, maybe they had to go to the office. Maybe there was something else that happened. There had been at least one racialized incident that I had experienced in school every single year of elementary school, from first grade through fifth grade. And so then it was like, I'm not going to say anything to my grownups about it because, I mean, my grandma is sick. I didn't want to burden my grownups. I was going to kind of go on. And that's kind of that's just what you have to do in those situations in a small town. You just kind of have to go on.
When we come back, Ali will share how her faith helps her fight the good fight, even when the world around her is on fire. That's coming next on Where You're From.
This episode is brought to you in part by Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Pittsburgh Theological Seminary students are grounded in faith and formed in community. PTS students are preparing for ministry with Master of Divinity, Master of Arts, Doctor of Ministry, and certificate programs. Begin your master's or certificate program in person or online. Financial aid is available. Visit pts.edu/admit.
What's up, Where You're From listeners? You like free stuff, right? Well, check this out to hear how you can get my favorite set of earphones, Power Beats Pro. I use these when I work out, cook, and when I'm listening to my favorite podcasts, like Where You're From. How can you enter to win the giveaway? Simply fill out our brief survey by clicking on the link in the show notes. Once you do that, you're entered to win. It's just that simple. So won't you do it right now? You'll have until November 7th, the day of the last episode of season 5, to enter. Thanks for listening to Where You're From. Peace, y'all. Hey, y'all, before we get back to our conversation with Ali Henney, I wanted to share a quick teaser from our next episode with Dahadi Lewis. This is Where You're From.
At this time, like, everything is coming at me. This is when Malcolm X was big, Farrakhan was big. I don't know any Christians, but I'm seeing Muslims, the Nation of Islam, like, they're in the neighborhood, they're in the places, and I don't see Christians anywhere kind of doing anything. So I remember talking to my mom And I was like, Mom, I don't understand all these religions. And I was just like, there are all these things. And I was like, so guess what? I'm just going to go together and I'm going to put all the best things of all the religions together and I'm going to make my own religion.
Now let's get back into our conversation with Ali Henney on Where You're From. In the book, at one point, you talk about how prayer has been an important tool for you. When did faith become an important part of your life and, you know, how that came to be and how that even helped you navigate some of these difficult things?
Yeah. So faith has always been part of my life. I cannot think of a time when faith wasn't part of my life. Growing up in the African-American culture, the generation, by generation, I'm an older millennial, and we were probably about the last group of people to really be raised in the Black church. I think that younger millennials and Gen Zers as a whole weren't raised in the church. They aren't churched the same way that we were churched. And so a lot of what I had was like this cultural faith of like, we are God-fearing people. And we would attend church, but we would kind of be in and out of church some just because of different dynamics, different things and stuff going on within the church in our small town. But my grandmother and my aunties and my mom are all God-fearing people. We're all God-fearing women. And I remember the first prayer my mom teaching me was a prayer before meal. You know, God is good, God is great, let us thank him for our food, amen. And I also, my mom, you know, taught me, now I lay me down to sleep, that prayer before bed. And I went to church at different points in my life. My little children's Bible was one of my favorite books. Like, there would be times I'd pull it out and I would just be looking at it, and I couldn't read. It was before I could read, but I'd be looking at the pictures and stuff and be looking at the picture of the crucifixion, which was really disturbing to me. It was scary. It was disturbing, but it was also that there was something about it that, like, even though it scared me and it disturbed me, I didn't understand quite until I was a little bit older. Preschool, kindergarten, did I kind of somewhat understand, but it was something that, you know, that I was drawn to. It was like my favorite song that we would sing in church would be At the Cross, or I Know It Was the Blood. I don't know why. I was just one that was like, oh, the crucifixion, let me be into that. But I was this weird little kid. But anyway, those were some of my foundations of faith and everything. And it's always been part of my life. My mom has always been, if something happens, you know, pray about it. Like, I remember my mom in middle school, I was having some issues, you know, the issues that girls just have with their friends, your friend group is shifting or whatever. And I remember my mom telling me, well, you know, if people give you in trouble, you need to read Psalm 35. And so read Psalm 35, and it comforted me. And if that one starts out, contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me. It's one of those imprecatory psalms, FYI. But my mom was like, that was knowledge that my grandma had. She was like, you know, mama always used to tell me, like, whenever people are giving you trouble, read Psalm 35. So that was knowledge that was handed down from my grandmother, that was probably, she probably got from her grandmother or one of her aunties and stuff. And that's just always been a part of my life. And prayer has just always been something that has always been there.
Yeah, I guess, and I'm curious, and maybe some of this is just going to be more like in hindsight, but, you know, I want you to put on your fuller seminary trained experience. But like, I'm seeing this thread of, you talk about in the book that you were often misunderstood. And even that there are aspects at home, obviously at school, in your community, and you love words. You know, you've been called the queen of words. You have this encounter with the living word. I'm just curious about, like, how do you think, again, maybe even in hindsight, this abiding, very natural type of faith that you had nurtured in you and that you cultivated, how do you think that helped you and frame, you know, your sense of self in the midst of a world that was oftentimes hostile to your sense of self?
You're right. Sometimes, you know, we have these concepts of ourselves that, you know, that our heart is exceedingly wicked and there's none that's good, no, not one, like all those other types of things. And I definitely, you know, want to acknowledge those understandings and those interpretations. Yet, whenever God created human beings in Genesis 1, whenever the whole creation story, everything, God saw that it was good. Even whenever we are deeply flawed, even whenever we're struggling and we're dealing with things, God saw that it was good. And then, you know, in the case of human beings, he realized that it wasn't good for us to be alone. It wasn't good for there to just be a person out here who was just out here alone on the earth. And so I think that all of that then to say that I recognize that, you know, the impulses that God has placed in me to do his will, I have a desire to make those things in my faith, those aspects of my faith, it not just to be a personal, individualized kind of thing, but for it to really be an aspect of the kingdom of God, the kingdom of God being within me and bringing the kingdom and the reign of God, participating in that kingdom of God, that reign of God. And so then, as my faith has helped me through some of these different aspects of adversity, it has given me something to cling to that is higher than myself. And so while it would be very easy to focus on the difficulty of my situation and the difficulties of the various trials and traumas and tribulations and stuff that I've been through, for me, God has been the person. He wasn't the author of the things that I experienced. I don't believe that. I don't believe that God is the author of our trials. Yes, God is all powerful. God can control everything, whatever. But for me, I don't think that God gave my grandma cancer. Like, I just don't think that God does that. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think God was like, hey, I'm going to create these horrible situations and put her in them. Right. I think that there's also an enemy, like in Matthew 13, the second parable of the sower, where it talks about how the sower sowed the good seed, and then who came in and sowed weeds among the good seed? It was the enemy. It was the devil. It was the enemy. Right. One of the ways to apply that is that, you know, like, God's out here sowing good. But there's somebody else. God's out here. His intent is for stuff to be good. But there's somebody else out there who does not want good. And so they're sowing all this other type of stuff in there. So I realized, look, God didn't want that. God didn't want my grandma to get sick. God didn't want me to experience all these different traumas and things. We haven't even talked about some of the things that I've experienced in white evangelical adjacent, because I was Pentecostal, so evangelical adjacent church spaces.
Right.
And God wasn't the author of that, but I realized that God can use that.
You know, I love what you have said. And by the way, I'm so glad that you did not remain or decide to shut up, because you have a lot of important and insightful things to say and a great mind to synthesize. But the one thing that I'm hearing you kind of draw together in that response, and even in Psalm 35 that you quoted, when, you know, that imprecatory prayer, contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me, fight against those who fight against me, that there's something that it seems like you picked up that understood that the mere fact that God would contend for us was a counter narrative, or revealed a counter narrative to those who were saying that you didn't have that worth and that your voice didn't matter, because God would not contend for somebody who isn't worth anything. Mm-hmm. And so there's something that you embraced and picked up on that has kind of continued to be a light. And yet at the same time, that's not just for you, but it's because he's put us on here to do stuff. And so when we talk about the kingdom and we talk about justice, you make this quote in your book that I just thought was really interesting. And you're right. Black people have chosen to worship a God who promises freedom from oppression. And I refuse to see something to whiteness that didn't start there. So, you know, this idea and this vision for racial justice, like, it doesn't all come together, you know, just when you hear that slur in fifth grade. But you talk about how even events, one of whom are known around the world, that happened in Missouri a few years ago, really helped catalyze your own understanding of the injustices in the world and God's call on your life to do something about it. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. So Michael Brown was killed August 9th, 2014. My oldest daughter was 3 months old, getting ready to be 4 months old in a few days. And suddenly the world just kind of felt like it was in upheaval. I lived in Virginia at the time. I was a new parent to a biological child I had fostered for several years before that. But I was recovering from a cesarean section, had this precious little baby who thankfully started sleeping through the night at 2 months old, so I wasn't completely sleep deprived. But this had this new person, this new wife that was making all these demands on my time and attention and everything. And so I watched a lot of Downton Abbey, cleaned a lot of baby stuff off of clothes. Babies, they come with a lot of stuff. Babies are very messy. And so you're always doing a lot of laundry. But anyway, I was watching Downton Abbey on repeat. And in the midst of this, I saw on Twitter that there was a young man who was killed outside of St. Louis in Missouri. And of course, you know, that's something that hit close to home. I'm from Kansas City area, but, you know, St. Louis, I see the arch whenever I go home, still from Chicago. I was watching just some of the different reports and stuff that people were, the things that people were saying, the commentary and stuff that was happening on Twitter. And I was like, oh my goodness, this sounds horrible. And as, you know, I'm following the different hashtags, kind of reading some of the discourse, I'm like, this is not just bad, this is really bad. And then eventually the protests and everything started, and I'm not watching Downton Abbey at this point. You know, I'm watching CNN, and I'm seeing images that look exactly like the images that, first of all, that I remember seeing in the early 90s after the Rodney King beating, the unrest that happened in Los Angeles in 1992. I remember being young, being a kid, and seeing that, but then also realizing, like, this doesn't just look like Los Angeles in 1992. This looks like Los Angeles, like the Watts riots in 1968. This looks like Chicago. This looks like Birmingham. This looks like all these different places. And nobody was saying it really at that point, but I recognized that this was the beginning of the civil rights movement in our day. Now, of course, you know, George Zimmerman had just been acquitted about 2 or 3 weeks before that. Eric Garner had been killed almost a month before that. Eric Garner and George Zimmerman, that had happened. And there had been some unrest, and I had seen some of that. And then, of course, whenever Trayvon was killed, there was all that. But there was something just particular to that moment in Ferguson. Yeah. And I realized that in that moment that my kid, if she was anything like me, whenever she read about it in history books, it wasn't a question of if, but when she would read about that in her history books, she would do the math like I did whenever I was a kid and did the math and knew how old, you know, my mom was in 1968 whenever King was killed, and how old she was, you know, in 1963 whenever Kennedy was killed, and how old she was whenever Brown versus Board of Education was passed, and all these other different things. My child was going to know that I was an adult, that I was 29 years old, and she was going to ask me, Mom, all this was going on, this new civil rights movement started to happen, where were you, what did you do? And I knew that my answer couldn't be, I was just out here, just, you know, you were a baby, and I was just watching Downton Abbey and changing your diaper and doing all your laundry. I knew that I had to do something, and so I didn't really have anything at that point to do other than be on social media and just kind of say, like, yeah, you know, this is a problem. And what you're seeing here is the outworking of years and decades and centuries of injustice. And just trying to explain to people, like trying to be like black grievance whisperer for some of these white people out here, just trying to say something. Because, of course, you know, being from Missouri, it was something that hit close to home for a lot of people. And so they were scared. And then people were saying some of the most horrible and most vilely racist things. And these are people, a lot of the people at that point that I was friends with on Facebook were people that I had attended church with whenever I was in college, whenever I was, you know, a young adult, people that I knew. I was their kid's youth pastor. I was there whenever their kids got baptized. Pentecostal, so I was one of the people praying for them whenever their kids spoke in tongues for the first time. I had sat in their homes. I had taken their kids to different things. And then all of a sudden, it was like none of my relationship with them mattered, because all they could do was to think about some of the most horrible things and act on some of the basest impulses. And if some people were digging down, they weren't digging down into the good. They were digging down into that racist programming that they had growing up in small towns as kids, growing up in cities that had histories of lynchings and all these other types of things. They were digging into that bag. They were digging down into that well, into that bitter cistern. And so I was trying so hard to help these people see without being like, you know, sinner, repent, without being like, you know, whatever. I mean, there were times where I was like, yeah, you know, the way that you're acting to that, that's sinful. Like, let's not get this twisted. But just trying to like be a voice in that. And so push came to shove. I realized that people started listening to things that I was saying. And my husband even kind of helped crystallize that for me. Like whenever things would happen, I would have people tell me, I'm coming to your personal Facebook profile because I want to know like what you think about it. I want to know what you have to say about it. I'd always been a writer. That's something that I just had always done since I could write. And some people think that my writing is worth reading. And so I realized like, oh, this is something that I can do. I can write things that help explain, that help to talk about, that help to bring to light, that help to uncover and expose, that challenge people, that pushes people out of their comfort zone. And that's what I started doing. And I wrote, and sometimes I would try to, you know, shepherd people because I also have that pastor's heart. So youth pastor, served as an associate pastor for several years. One day will pastor again, Lord willing, whenever I'm ordained in the Episcopal Church. We'll see what God does with that. But that's just what I default to. So it's like I'm trying to not just, you know, tell people off, but I'm really, really trying to help people, help my friends understand why this hurts. And I kept doing that and kept doing it and experienced adversity in doing it, you know, lost friendships, lost people, lost communities, lost a lot of different things. And I will continue to do this until, you know, the Lord is like, hey, you know, you're done with that part of your life. There are things that I would not be able to do if it were not for the Lord. There were times whenever I wanted to give up. There were times whenever I wanted to just be like, I'm not doing this anymore, whatever. And the Lord was the one who kept giving me the words, who kept pushing me, who kept encouraging me, the Lord, and then the Lord through others in my community, just really, really pushing me, really spurring me on and encouraging me to live into whatever this calling really, whatever it is, but what it looks like, the manifestation of that in terms of writing and speaking and teaching and educating. It's work that I really feel like that the Lord has brought me into. And so I realize that the Lord has brought me into the work. It's not been people. And so the Lord is the one who can also take me out of the work. And at whatever point he decides to take me out of it. Okay.
You know, one of the things that was the most touching for me in your book, I Won't Shut Up, is three acts, and it kind of moves through your story and making some poignant insights. And before you get into the practical side in Act Three, it has this intermission, which is a letter to my children. And you're right, I'll just pull out a couple lines. To my most precious and most special children, Ezra and Lysander. You might be wondering why I wrote a letter to you and why I put it in my book. I wanted to put a letter to you into my book because you two are the reason why I am writing. And then you go on to say, I hope that one day when the opportunity comes, both of you will be able to use your voices to stand up for Black people's rights and help them lead our people to freedom. No matter what, I always love you both. I'm proud of you and know that our ancestors are proud of you too. May our Lord Jesus Christ always lead you and may his Holy Spirit always bring you comfort and peace. Love, Mommy. I ain't going front. I had a hard time keeping the dust out of my eye reading that. Very moving, very touching. Tell us a little bit more about not only how you found your voice, but also developed a passion for your daughter's finding theirs, and what's it been like on the other side of it now that the book is out and, you know, and you've had opportunity to talk to them?
Yeah, you know, it's been great. I have read that part of the book to them. My kids have been very kind of excited about, like, oh, wow, mommy has a book. And whenever it came and they actually got to see it, it was like, wow. Because we love books in my family. We are a book family. We are a public library. Like, my oldest actually was upset because she had to do the dishes. She had to put the dishes in the dishwasher before she could read her book. And we had some big feelings that we had to work through. But it's like, I wanted to include that because I wanted to include them in it, because me doing any of this, me having any of the things that I have, is because of them. It's because I wanted to try to make the world a better place for them. And I realize, you know, that the world will hopefully be a somewhat better place, but the way that things are going, the world might not be a better place in my lifetime. There are things that I might not see in my lifetime. There are things that even my kids might not see in their lifetime. But I try to do this with them just in life, in equipping them to be able to stand up for themselves and we can talk about injustice like racism and that, but even just being able to stand up for themselves in life, to be able to stand up to bullies, to be able to stand up to people who are unkind and who don't take care of people well. Mm-hmm. I try to instill in them to be thoughtful and to be concerned about others and to exercise that care for others. I really try to give voice to that desire, because it's one thing to write something down, right? But it's a whole other different ideal to live them. And so, you know, my kids have seen me, you know, going to protests. Whenever I first moved to Chicago, that was like literally that week was George Floyd. So we weren't even unpacked good, but I had a lot of cardboard to be able to make protest signs with. My kids, you know, saw me going to the George Floyd protests. My kids saw me going downtown after Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted. They've seen me show up in that space. I try to model that for them, but I also try to model not just like the protests and the activism, but also the gaining knowledge, the teaching, the preaching, all those different types of things. I really try to involve them in as much as I can, as much as is appropriate. They know what I do, but they don't quite understand it. They're not quite at the age where they will fully understand it. But I want people to be like, oh, wow, my mom was like, yeah, she was really out here. She was kind of like, you know, protesting, and she was working like with community groups, and she was preaching, and she was educating people, and she was doing all these types of things. Like, I want for them to recognize that, like, later in life, like what they got to see and what they got to participate in to some small degree, but for them to just be them and our family to just be our family, and for them to know our family's values, but for it to not be like such a thing that they take it for granted, like what they are experiencing in the life that they're living.
Well, that's beautiful. And in addition to being an author, you also are the vice president of The Witness, a Black Christian collective. And I'm just curious, like, how does this drive and this calling to use your voice for the marginalized, how does that play into this role and assignment you've taken on with The Witness?
The Witness has been a good opportunity for me to really be in that space and really be bringing people together, helping Black people to be able to encourage them and educate them and empower them to be able to experience an embodied form of liberation. And, you know, the Witness exists to address the core concerns of Black Christians. We focus on justice and stuff a lot because our work has necessitated that. Mm-hmm. And so then speaking to those things from a decidedly Black, decidedly Christian perspective, and it's been good to then be able to kind of craft and cultivate what that looks like and to be able to speak to issues that people are dealing with, and even giving voice to some of the experiences that people have. Often our material, our podcasts, our blog, the different things that we do, our events, our conferences, those things speak to people who are on that journey. And then there's some of us who've been on the journey for a long, long time at this point. And we have things that hopefully speak to people who are figuring out that journey. We had a campaign a few years ago called Leave Loud, where we were really encouraging Black Christians that if they were going to leave these spaces, these churches, these ministries, whatever, where they were being harmed, to not just do so like you kind of go out and turn around and go and whatever, but to actually name what was happening to them. Because so many times we suffer our pain in silence. We suffer in silence, and so when we think that we're alone. Yeah. And so really a lot of the impulse behind Leave Loud was like, speak up. Because first of all, people need to know what happened. And it's not, we're not trying to be vindictive. You're not trying to harm people. You're not trying to, you know, put people on blast. But it's more like, this experience that I had, or this place that I was in, was not a safe place for me. And I'm going to name that. I'm going to say that out loud. And I'm going to tell the people, I'm not just going to, you know, suddenly just stop going to church there and, you know, show up someplace else. I'm going to tell them, this isn't okay. What's happening here isn't okay. And I'm leaving because this isn't okay. We really want to empower people then, whenever they find themselves dealing with the toxic version of white Christianity, how to do that, and being a voice of hopefully of reason, of comfort, and of truth to people. And there are a lot of non-Black people who rock with The Witness, and I love that. But we really, you know, want to create something that's by us and for us, and is a space that feels like they can receive the healing, the refreshing, the different things that they need, even as they maybe, you know, might feel called to some of these spaces, and they're making a difference. Mm. So being able to be that source of nourishment, to be that river in the desert for some people. And that's really, it's an assignment that I don't take lightly, because we see this every day where so many people, they're fainting, you know, because they're not seeing the goodness. And, you know, I know that I would have fainted if I hadn't believed that I'd see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. So for me, this is an assignment of helping for people to see the goodness of the Lord. Mm-hmm. And I think of also, you know, Isaiah 40, you know, helping people to mount up on wings mm-hmm. like eagles, so they will run and not grow weary, walk and not faint.
This is Where You're From. I'm Rossell Berry. And remember, it's not just about where you're at. It's also about where you're from. This show was produced by Ryan Clevenger, Mary Jo Clark, and Jade Gussman, and was engineered by Kevin Burgess. Also want to thank Will and Mike for their help in supporting and promoting Where You're From. Thanks, y'all.
Where You're From is part of the Voices Collection from Our Daily Bread Ministries.